within the framework of the JCPOA.
We received written guarantees. They are included in the text of the agreement itself on the resumption of the JCPOA on the Iranian nuclear program. These texts provide reliable protection for all the projects and areas of activity envisaged by the JCPOA, including the direct involvement of our companies, specialists, including their cooperation on such a flagship project of our cooperation as the Bushehr nuclear power plant, in the context of all existing plans in this regard.
Lavrov also rejected claims that Russia has created an obstacle to negotiations in the Austrian capital, backing the quick revival of the 2015 agreement.
There have been no exorbitant demands from our side, and there are none. All our rights within the framework of cooperation with Iran on the projects that the JCPOA provides for are reliably protected. I have heard how the Americans are trying to accuse us every day that we are slowing down this agreement. That's a lie. The agreement has not yet been finally approved in some capitals, and the Russian capital, Moscow, is not among them.
Amir Abdullahian and Lavrov also discussed other issues, including the Ukrainian conflict and regional issues such as developments in Afghanistan, Syria and Yemen.
The foreign ministers, along with political and diplomatic issues, discussed economic affairs in order to neutralize the negative impacts and consequences of the U.S. and Western anti-Moscow sanctions through closer cooperation and rapprochement. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The figures were stark, even for those used to dealing with sobering news coming out of Riyadh. The news that the kingdom had executed 81 individuals with little fanfare. The news that British Prime Minister Boris Johnson would then be travelling to Saudi Arabia to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman could not have come at a more politically sensitive time. Various officials, including Health Secretary Sajid Javid, attempted to justify the trip by saying Britain had a very candid and frank relationship with the Persian Gulf state, with Downing Street adding that the UK was still very much against the death penalty. Britain has entered some questionable partnerships in order to secure its own interests in the past and is able to turn a blind eye when it's convenient. But the decision to send the British Prime Minister to Saudi Arabia in the immediate aftermath of a controversial mass execution seems a baffling one. The plan is for the UK PM to convince the Saudis to raise oil and gas production to make up for a reduced reliance on Russia. Boris Johnson has a cost of living crisis on his hands, the biggest squeeze on incomes in over three decades. The UK crisis has caused the UK government to scramble for energy solutions. But is further reliance on Riyadh sensible? Critics argue a resounding no. Amina Taylor, London.
The United Nations WFP has expressed concern about the situation of children in Afghanistan, announcing that acute malnutrition rates are high in 28 out of 34 provinces of the country. The UN body says 3.5 million Afghan children currently need nutrition treatment. The head of Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital believes this situation is due to cuts in global aid and mass poverty triggered by U.S. sanctions.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers can't afford enough nutrients at the time of pregnancy. When the mother herself suffers from undernutrition, the baby, of course, becomes malnourished. In addition to providing milk and nutrients, health bodies should also provide such families with some cash aid for a specific period of time so that the mother and children don't face malnourishment after recovering.
Some Afghan mothers also say they can't provide their babies with needed nutrition, as their entire families are going without food to eat.
I'm a widow. I can't afford a packet of flour to cook bread. My family members are going without food to eat. There is no male breadwinner in our household. This daughter of mine is malnourished, and I'm afraid the other children also become undernourished if this situation continues.
The UNHCR says that at the Antalya Diplomacy Forum, everyone agreed that in spite of the extreme gravity of the Ukraine situation, other crises, including that of Afghanistan, must not be forgotten. Afghans are also calling on Western powers not to ignore the crisis they caused in Afghanistan.
Western powers caused the situation in our country. They imposed the war and control everything here. Today they are shifting all attention to the Ukraine crisis. That is important, but what about Afghans' plight? They shouldn't forget poor and suffering Afghans.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and major funding to the country was halted. The developments affected lives across the country. The situation is still perilous in Afghanistan, where millions of lives depend on foreign aid. Afghan people are calling on world countries not to forget them and to continue their assistance to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Majlis-e-Wahdat-e Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims.
Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society.
After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities Pasmane Azhar Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signaling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises, first in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result, came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last three decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
With the Persian New Year, or Nowruz, being just around the corner in Iran, people are getting prepared to welcome the arrival of spring. This comes as the sixth wave of coronavirus in Iran appears to have been subsiding now. The official daily number of fatalities, which had stood at 241 on February 27th, fell to below 120 over the past couple of days. The Persian New Year, or Nowruz, arrives on March 21st. The Nowruz holidays are traditionally a time when Iranians travel and visit each other. But health officials are worried that the exchange of visits and travels during the Persian New Year will lead to a new wave of COVID-19 if health protocols are not fully observed.
In view of this special feature of the Omicron variant, we highly request people to keep wearing masks and observe social distancing. Although many of them have been vaccinated, wearing a mask is still an important measure, especially when they are visiting relatives and friends during Nowruz.
I think everyone should receive the third dose of vaccine. And if you want to be safe, we should postpone our visiting and travels to some other time. If we don't take Omicron seriously, the next wave will sweep across the country again.
I have recovered from coronavirus almost 20 days now, but too much coughing hurts me a lot, and symptoms are still with me and my daughter. It's a bad disease, and people should not forget to observe the health protocols.
According to official statistics, over 56 million Iranians have received the second jabs of vaccines, while over 24 million others have been vaccinated with the third shot.
Under the travel rules released for Iran's third Nowruz with COVID-19, only those who have received at least two doses of vaccines are allowed to travel by their private cars across the country during the Persian New Year holidays. Otherwise, they will be fined. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
What the fuck? people in the blockaded Gaza Strip attended a big ceremony to mark the 54th anniversary of the Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to the tens of thousands of Palestinians who got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffered from permanent disabilities during Israeli wars. Israeli forces have also injured some 30,000 peaceful Palestinian protesters who were taking part in the Great March of Return rallies. Hamas movement, which organized the event, accused the Israeli regime of committing crimes against the Palestinian people.
The amount, the volume, the size of the injury indicated that we are facing a criminal side, which is occupation. I think it is very important indication about the type and the impact of the Israeli actions, Israeli crimes against the Palestinian.
During the Israeli war in May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation.
We have to stress the role of the wounded in Palestine and their great role. They are Palestinian, you know, wounded are in the first line with the occupation. So they sacrifice with their bodies in order to, free Palestine.
Palestinians say that Tel Aviv's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as it enjoys protection from Western countries. The Islamic Jihad movement accused the United States of encouraging Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people.
I think that who give the Israeli the green light, Americans, the United States of America, and the silence of people, which silenced all over the massacre which carried by the Israelis against our people, and also maybe the Arab position, so that the Israelis go on to destroy, to kill, to injure everything against our people.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has made it even worse for wounded Gazans who require rehabilitation and artificial limbs.
Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since 2008, amid what observers describe as an international conspiracy of silence. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
South Korea elected a new president Wednesday as Conservative People Power Party candidate Yoon Suk-yeol defeated progressive Lee Jae-myung by less than 1% after all the votes were tallied. Yoon was quick to outline the hard line he will take with North Korea.
In order to protect the safety of our people, property, territory, and sovereignty, we will build a strong military capacity that can reliably suppress any provocation. I'll firmly deal with illicit, unreasonable behavior by North Korea in a principled manner, though I'll always leave the door for South-North talks open.
North Korea conducted several missile tests in the weeks leading up to the election. Some analysts believe President-elect Yoon, a former prosecutor entering politics for the first time, will face some early challenges from Pyongyang.
The Conservative Party has been very critical of the government's position on military exercises. Of course, South Korea will come out with a new North Korea policy, but North Korea will also conduct a couple of activities to test the Yoon administration. I'm not sure whether this will lead to conflict or dialogue.
The Moon Jae-in administration had sought engagement with North Korea, but its policies were often stymied by a hardline U.S. approach. Yoon Suk-yeol's foreign policy marks a stark turnaround from outgoing President Moon Jae-in, particularly concerning North Korea. Yoon advocates the deployment of a second U.S. anti-ballistic missile battery to protect the capital, Seoul, the resumption of joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and the preparation for South Korea's military to execute a preemptive strike on North Korea should Pyongyang pose an imminent threat. In addition to the difficult North Korea issue, President-elect Yoon will have to deal with a raft of domestic problems, including a housing price bubble and income gap, a surge in COVID-19, as well as rising inflation. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A Cult in Heart of the Republic is the title of a book written by a member of the French Senate, Nathalie Goulet.
In her book, she shines a light into the formidable anti-Iran terror group known as Mojahedin-e-Khalq Organization, or simply the MKO. The author tries to warn her fellow Senate members that a full-scale terror group exists in the heart of the French Republic. Here, in Iran's city of Qom, political thinkers and activists have gathered to unveil the first Persian translation of the French book.
In the book, A Cult in Heart of the Republic, Mrs. Goulet writes about the grisly crimes against humanity perpetrated by the MKO and how they crushed all humanitarian principles to ascend to power in Iran. The author warns the French parliament that the formidable group now enjoys full financial support from Paris and is infiltrating into the French government.
The group also fought alongside Iraqi forces against Iran during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s.
During the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the group tried to take power in Iran. But when they failed because of lack of popularity, they tried to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic. The MKO brainwashes its members and does not allow them to get married and form a family. They are like a war machine, which are designed to kill.
In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. The terror group was then relocated from an American military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Since then, the U.S. and Europe have been taking part in the MKO's annual summits in Paris. Natalie Golay's book tries to highlight the criminal track record of the MKO, while warning France that it's making a big mistake by supporting the terror group.
France is a country that claims to care about money laundering on the global stage. But based on Nathalie Goulet's book, the French government is conducting large-scale money laundering to fund the MKO terrorists. The U.S. also lends its political support to the terror group. This is both double standards and folly, because the MKO's functionality has long expired.
The MKO is currently led by 68-year-old Maryam Rajavi, who is facing pressure from French human rights entities as, quote, a smear on France's record of human rights advocacy.
Aside from warning France of the security threats posed to her country by the MKO, the French author says capitalizing on the terror group is nothing but a waste of time and money. She argues that the MKO is viewed as an obsolete killing machine in the minds of Iranians and has no place in Iran's sociopolitical structure. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Congratulations to everyone on 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. We hereby at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Saudi Arabia is considering ditching the dollar for Chinese oil sales. That is big news, since this challenges the supremacy of the dollar. But why would Saudi Arabia consider this? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Saudi Arabia's move means that it no longer views the U.S. as a reliable ally, and if this means that Saudi Arabia, like Russia, China, Iran, and some other nations, is moving to limit its dependence on the dollar. Well, first, let me introduce the guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Arnold August joins us. He's an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal. Also joining us is John Ross, senior fellow at Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Hi, I'd like to welcome you both, gentlemen. Arnold August, I'm going to first start with you, if I may. We're looking at something that has been in the works for quite some time, but it is very significant in terms of it being enacted, and that is for the Saudi Arabia to consider ditching the dollar at this point, with some saying that that actually is going to happen. Tell us what, for Chinese oil sales, tell us what this exactly means vis-a-vis the dollar.
Well, this new financial arrangement, if I'm not mistaken, has been in the works for over around 6 years, with the Chinese payment system being used increasingly, such as UnionPay and other Chinese-centered financial arrangements with Asian countries as well. So this is not new, but it is very significant in the current situation because of the whole international situation is changing rapidly as a result of the war in Ukraine. And as you mentioned, in that context, you actually have Saudi Arabia refusing, and one other Arab country, refusing to answer Biden's call to supposedly work out an arrangement to increase oil production. So it is very significant. I mean, looking at it from the point of view internationally, I think that the U.S., increased its pressure and aggression against Russia because they were losing the grip of what they insist on having a unipolar world with U.S. hegemony. But it actually backfired within a few weeks, with the result being that the multipolar world is even increasing in size. So Russia has is increasing its partnership with China with regards to exchange and other economic activities. And, China is also working with other things. The sanctions, they did not work against China or Cuba. They did not work against Venezuela. They did not work against Iran. Mm-hmm. And this is, we see this playing out now also, that it's not going to work with regards to Russia.
Perhaps looking at this, John Ross, we're looking at what has been the dominant, currency based on the way that oil is traded, and it's based on the dollar. Now, China is putting pressure on the dollar through its competition of its currency by the name of the yuan, and this term, the petro yuan, comes about. So is this perhaps the beginning of the dollar being thrown off its reign? Were the petro yuan gain popularity, which it has been? It's been introduced nationally in China in terms of the digital yuan, and in that respect, it has also been successful. So can you put this all into context for us?
Yes, obviously, foreign countries want to have a stable currency which maintains its value and so on, because they don't want to invest in a currency which loses a great deal of its value. And the Chinese yuan, or RMB as it's technically known, has been very stable currency. So it's therefore very suitable for doing international exchanging. But historically, the most stable of all these things has been gold. But after the dollar, after the gold standard collapsed in about 1930s, the dollar took over. But now we have a different situation. Firstly, the dollar itself is becoming unstable economically. And secondly, it's being used as an instrument of international pressure. And countries don't want to be subject to this. You know, it's one thing to have, you know, you can accept that you have a currency which is stable, you can use for foreign exchange and so on, and for foreign trade, that's fine. But the US is now using the dollar unilaterally as an instrument for its foreign policy, and therefore an increasing number of countries want to rebel against this. They don't want it. They don't want to be subject to economic blackmail by the US. Now, it's economically very rational, but it would be a very big decision for Saudi Arabia to decide to trade oil in Chinese yuan. So the US, I'm sure, will be doing everything possible. You know, the telephone lines are humming between Saudi Arabia and the US at the present time for the US to try to stop it happening.
Well, who is it humming with? Because from what we understand, Arnold August, that the U.S. President Joe Biden does not even talk to and recognize the Saudi Crown Prince. I mean, during his campaign trail, he talked about how Saudi Arabia is a pariah state. But since we're talking about Saudi Arabia, we should probably put the UAE here and the fact that the U.S. is being rejected by these two. Of course, we know the U.K. Prime Minister is out making a tour of the Persian Gulf countries, UAE and Saudi Arabia. The fact that you have these two snubbing the U.S., does that mean that we're looking at a breakdown in the system in terms of a geopolitical shift affecting the energy market, in this case, petroleum, and then as a consequence, the dollar?
Yes, I think so. I think one event that highlights what you're just saying is the vote in the United Nations General Assembly a few weeks ago on the U.S. Proposed resolution to condemn Russian invasion of Ukraine. There were 35 countries that abstained, and significantly, if I remember correctly, Saudi Arabia was one of them. So that is a, you know, John Ross deals with the economic situation very well. I would just like to highlight this, the political significance when there is so much conflict internationally as a result of Ukraine. And the United States hoping for a blanket condemnation, you actually have countries such as Saudi Arabia who actually abstain, which is very significant. So do countries such as Pakistan. And these countries in Asia are potential partners of China in order to, protect Russia against the freezing of Russian assets. The freezing of assets is a new war, actually an instrument of war by the United States against country. We saw that in Venezuela. Now we're seeing that in Russia. But this will only further increase the determination of these countries, even the people of these countries who are not foolish. They are very political, such as in Russia. They know what is happening. To increase that impetus to what we are seeing now, I believe, is the decoupling of Russia from Europe. So you have Russia inevitably going towards further economic, political relations with China. And in that, we also have Saudi Arabia. So I think it's very significant.
Sure. And it's interesting that you talk about that, because that's being mentioned quite a bit. And perhaps, Arnold August, before we get into that more, you use the word economic blackmail that the U.S. uses. I think that's how you termed it. Tell us more how this dollar, and in turn sanctions, I would say, is being used as what they have called, whoever it is, analysts, books, you name it, the weaponization of the dollar. How does the U.S. do that? We know countries that are not in line with the U.S. foreign policy are the ones that fall prey to that.
Yes. Well, the fact is...
For John Ross. I apologize. Let me get to John Ross, because I asked the question. John Ross, go ahead.
Yes. What is happening is you have to have a currency. It could be gold. I mean, it doesn't have to be a paper money. Gold for many centuries was the key feature of the situation, which is acceptable to all countries. And it means it acts as neutral. It's just a means of payment, etc. So... perhaps it gives a bit of advantage to one country over the other, but it's more or less acceptable. But what the US has now introduced is it's attempting to use the control of the dollar, which is its currency, to attack numerous countries, to attack Venezuela, to attack Russia, to attack Iran, and to attack other countries. And other countries do not want to be subject to a situation which you no longer have a relatively neutral, not a perfectly neutral, but, you know, sort of reasonable type of international form of currency. And instead, this has been replaced by an instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Therefore, a number of countries are wanting to get out of this situation. The difficulty is that if you want to engage in international trade, and if you want to have international currencies, you have to have an alternative to the dollar. The traditional one has been gold. And it's very significant that Russia has greatly increased the proportion of its foreign exchange reserves, which are held in gold. But the RMB has also become, China's yuan has become a very reliable and stable currency. So therefore, from an economic point of view, many countries are quite prepared to accept the yuan. But of course, the US doesn't like this because it messes up US foreign policy. So this is the conflict between economic and political aspects of the present situation.
Well, Arnold August, it's interesting when you take a look at the list of countries that the U.S. is either threatened militarily or has been on the receiving end of these sanctions. They're the ones that actually are involved on U.S. radars to be pretty much shunned out of the system. I could go down the list here. I'm looking at Syria, Libya. These are countries that don't want or are not using the dollar. Iraq, they were all attacked by the U.S. Other countries like Turkey, at this point Russia for sure, and China, well, they've been somewhat been on the receiving end. Russia obviously now completely banned, but China also a victim of these sanctions, and it has been threatened by U.S. in one way or another. Analysts are saying that this is because they want to do away with the dollar. Is that because if that happens, if the dollar is not the dominant currency, then that means that the U.S. economy, by many accounts, would actually fall apart. So is that why the U.S. is obviously very sensitive on this?
Yes, of course. They want to maintain, even though it is a hopeless wish, maintain the domination of the dollar. But it's not working. I have to refer once again to the political side of it, because that's what I know best. And after the vote took place in the United Nations, it was significant. The president of Pakistan, when asked why Pakistan did not support the U.S. resolution on Ukraine, said, "We are not lackeys of anyone. We want to do what we have to do." And also, not long after that, Lithuania, a very strong ally of the Ukrainian government and the U.S., punished Bangladesh because it did not vote with the United Nations in the General Assembly, punished Bangladesh by stopping the shipment of anti-COVID-19 medication to that country. So, you know, people all over the world are, you know, very sensitive to the situation. I mean, the United States, the way that mass media operates in Canada must be the same in Britain, John could tell us. But, you know, they keep on repeating the international community. Well, who is that international community? It's mainly United States, Canada, Australia, UK, etc. Now, if you take the countries that are not part of this international community, such as China, Pakistan, India, it's a very important portion, not only of the world population, but also of the world economy. Even in Latin America, which is very far removed from Ukraine and the current situation, in a way, many Latin American countries have taken a stand to not condemn Russia for its military operation in Ukraine. So I think we're going through a major shift internationally that is going to go even further in the coming days and months. As the United States, even though they're very confident that Zelensky spoke to Congress yesterday, he spoke to the Canadian Parliament, and everyone is very euphoric. But the world is not working the way the U.S. really wants it, because other countries, other peoples, other governments are looking at it and do not, you know, I don't think they're very impressed with Zelensky's call in the U.S. Congress for a no-fly zone, which would eventually lead to World War III. So this would have repercussions economically as well. Like, which country in Asia, Africa, and Latin America would want to deal with the United States if they're, you know, actually closely linked to someone who wants a no-fly zone that would inevitably lead to a third world war?
Sure. Well, John Ross, there has been motions now in the works for a number of years when it comes to bilateral trade between countries that are not using the dollar. We could talk about how Russia and Iran are doing that, also Russia and China, Iran and Turkey, to name just a couple instances, along with the fact that both China and Russia have devised financial payment systems that are outside of what's known as SWIFT, which is the international payment system, which has a lot of, obviously, outlets. Even though their payment system doesn't add up number-wise, it's still outside of SWIFT, which is obviously then not within the reach of the arms of the U.S. sanction to those countries. Do you think that there's a motion enough towards de-dollarization that would then push the dollar off being the dominant currency when you have bilateral trade happening between countries that have opted not to use the dollar?
Well, this is a slow and strong and difficult process, because if you don't use the dollar, you have to have an alternative. And therefore, you have to have something which is stable. I'm whatever you think about Russia, for example, the ruble can't be an anchor of the international monetary system because its exchange rate is too unstable. The one which historically was dominant and which could be returned to is gold, because no single country controls the production of gold in the world. Therefore, it operates in a relatively neutral fashion. One is to return to gold, and there is indeed a tendency to return to gold. Russia has built up a very large part of its foreign exchange reserves in terms of gold. The RMB, however, the Chinese yuan, is also a relatively stable currency at the present time because of the strength of the Chinese economy. So therefore, yes, these are processes which are undermining the dollar, and there's an interaction between economics and politics. You have to have a relatively stable currency, and I would say the combination of gold and the RMB is stable. And you also have to have the fact you don't want to be controlled by US foreign policy. So there is an undermining of the dollar. The reason why the Saudi Arabian discussion is taking place, and despite the fact that the leadership of Saudi Arabia is not taking phone calls from the United States at the present time, I think there are a lot of phone calls that are trying to be put through to Saudi Arabia, is yes, this would be a very big break with the domination of the dollar. So there's a fight which is going on here, which is going to last, in my opinion, the next 5 to 10 years. It's not going to be decided very quickly.
The decoupling is something that I'd like to ask you, Arnold August, when you mentioned it, which I think is very important. Both Russia, as you said, from Europe, and in a sense, we're looking at maybe Saudi Arabia with the announcement that it made. We know that Iran is also pivoting towards the East more. And then you have China, obviously, at the center here, but it's not the only country. There are trade blocks like the RCEP, the biggest trading bloc in the world, which the U.S. is not a member. You have trade blocks like the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran became a member, U.S. not a member. So are there enough countries that are aligning each other, decoupling from the West in a sense, and will they be able to withstand, with the way that the U.S. is conducting itself and alienating itself, to then succeed without having that much of the U.S., influence in the economic sphere?
Yeah, I think the decoupling of Russia from Europe is taking place simultaneously and necessarily with the coupling, using that same word, Russia with other important economic powers such as China, and even closer ties with Iran. So this is bound to increase even further. I mean, if these countries were watching the Zelensky's address to the U.S. Congress calling the United States the leader of the free world and all that, this is not going to help the allies of the United States, even in Europe. You know, like the sanctions that the United States is carrying out against Russia, it affects Europe quite a bit more than the United States, because Europe relies far more on Russian oil and gas in comparison to the United States. And it's obvious, you know, Europeans, even though they are going along with the United States at this time, I'm not too sure how Europe will continue going along with the United States when they are bearing the brunt of the sanctions against Russia, because they rely more on oil and gas from Russia, and thus necessarily looking for other alternatives in terms of gas and oil.
Right. Final question goes to you, John Ross. Many people don't realize, but the number one trading partner for the EU is China. And therefore, I'm asking you now, how can the EU then follow the U.S. lead? It already has come out and said, we're not going to go with the sanctions or the embargo on Russia. It said we're going to give a plan in May, and we will then, by the year 2027, see if we will, not deal with Russia. So do you think that there's a divergence there? And does that help, again, push for trade not being used with the dollar?
Yeah, there is certainly a divergence, but I would be, in the end, in geopolitics, military power and political power is more important than economics. And the European Union, in my opinion, will capitulate to the United States. Not totally, not completely. It will try to avoid it, but that's what it will do, and its people will suffer. I would like to give another answer, but that's my honest opinion.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you very much for that. Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal, thank you for your input. And John Ross there, senior fellow at the Chung-Yung Institute for Financial Studies from London. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tarvay, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Neither Bush nor Rumsfeld had the legal authority to permit government agents to commit felonies, though we now know that they did, says Andrew P. Napolitano writer in an article published under the heading Military Torturers at Guantanamo Bay. Stay tuned for more. After a jury in 2006 declined to impose the death penalty on Zacharias Moussaoui, who had just pleaded guilty to being the 20th 9/11 hijacker, the government announced that another person was the 20th. Yet that person, Muhammad al-Ghahtani, was ordered released from the U.S. naval prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, recently. Here is the backstory. Moussaoui had been living in Minnesota and taking flying lessons when he was arrested in August 2001 for an immigration violation. When officials questioned him, the answers he gave aroused their suspicions about what he intended to do with a plane once he was qualified to fly. The FBI conducted a criminal investigation, and shortly after 9/11, Moussaoui was indicted in Virginia for conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism on 9/11. The government sought the death penalty. 5 years later, he pleaded guilty during his trial. The court then conducted a penalty phase trial before the same jury that had been hearing the case prior to the guilty plea. The jury declined to impose the death penalty, with some jurors revealing their beliefs that he had nothing to do with 9/11, but was a jihadi wannabe. The judge sentenced him to life in prison without possibility of parole. Stung by the jury's verdict on the death penalty, the government changed its characterization of Musaie on the 20th hijacker and declared that Muhammad al-Qahtani was the real 20th hijacker. In August 21, Qahtani had attempted to enter the United States at Orlando International Airport, where Muhammad Atta, one of the true hijackers, was waiting to greet him. Immigration officials rejected Qahtani's paperwork and sent him back to Dubai. U.S. forces arrested him in Pakistan in December 21 and accused him of being Osama bin Laden's bodyguard. He was transferred to the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, where he was tortured for 2 months in 2002 and 2003 by the military, pursuant to orders issued by Secretary of Defense Donald H. Rumsfeld. He told his torturers what he thought they wanted to hear. His torture was so persistent and horrific that army medics were frequently called upon to prevent his death and to revive him for his frequent blackouts so that the torture could resume. When detailed logs of his torture were leaked to the media, Susan J. Crawford, President George W. Bush's emissary overseeing tortures and prosecutions at Gitmo, acknowledged publicly that we tortured him and thus it would be impossible to try him, unquote. Recently, the U.S. government decided to release Qahtani, whom it believes was the true 20th hijacker, to officials in Saudi Arabia. The stated reason for his release is his diminished mental capacity. The true reason is that he has become an embarrassment for the U.S. government. Gitmo prosecutors told the Bush Departments of Justice and Defense that no judge would permit a prosecution where the principal evidence against the accused was obtained from his torture. Qahtani's case is a lesson in the clash between human rights and unbridled government. If Rumsfeld had listened to government lawyers, he would have known that the American civilian and military legal systems are based on the inalienability of certain rights and values, and among them are bodily integrity, the presumption of innocence, and the rule of law. The Supreme Court jurisprudence on bodily integrity prohibits the introduction of anything into or upon the body of any person against his will. This includes everything from face masks to whips and chains to chemicals in the veins. The rule of law in America makes the intentional infliction of pain and severe discomfort by the government upon a prisoner a felony. The horrific Bush-inspired scenario actually happened. After Bush lost at the Supreme Court, the U.S. government outsourced its torture and now finds itself as a witness in cases against the foreign torturers whom it hired to torture its prisoners. Even worse, the man jurors found was not the 20th hijacker is in prison for life, and the man the U.S. government says was the 20th hijacker will soon be free. This is what happens when the U.S. government breaks its own laws and violates the Constitution that they have hired it to uphold.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.